When you invest in ETFs, your capital is at risk. This show is for professional investors only.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Thematic Matters, the new thematic investing podcast from Han ETF, Europe's most extensive thematic ETF issuer. So today, I'm delighted to say we're joined by John Cimpaglia, who's a CEO of Sprott Asset Management. So Sprott is a Canadian-based asset manager with a particular expertise, among other things, in the uranium space. Sprott oversees a US ETF with over $1 billion in AUM and a physical uranium trust with around $3 billion in AUM. And Han ETF recently listed a UCITS version of the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF across Europe. Please remember that this podcast is for professional investors only. So John, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we get into uranium itself, perhaps it's worth covering more broadly nuclear energy, which is obviously the end use of uranium. So there's something of a renaissance in nuclear energy going on, it seems. There's much more talk about its potential viability and use in the future. So maybe we could start with some of the drivers of this. So the first perhaps being the commitment of economies around the world to net zero. So why should we see nuclear energy as a greener alternative to gas and oil and coal?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, it really does start with nuclear power. That's really what's driving uranium and the uranium related mining equities. So I think many people in the last 12 months are talking about a new nuclear renaissance. And I think there's a number of catalysts as to why this is happening. First and foremost, it was really about energy transition and decarbonization. And the number of countries around the world that have committed to net zero pledges. And so, you know, if you're going to make a pledge to net zero, you really have to look at your entire energy system. And energy systems around the world are really based on fossil fuels. I think most people would be astonished that the number one fuel source for energy production globally today in 2022 is coal. So you think of coal as being a very archaic, old type of fuel that we've been using, obviously, for probably 150 plus years. But it is still the number one source for electricity production. Coal is the dirtiest form in terms of CO2 and other chemical emissions that are negative for the environment. So the world is still very dependent on coal. And if you're wondering why, it's really about cost. It's cheap and it's plentiful. So whether you're an emerging economy like India or an economy that's very large but still transitioning in some capacities like China, coal is a huge part of your fuel chain. So a lot of governments around the world are looking at their overall fuel mix, supply mix of energy sources and saying, look, renewables have received a lot of investment, massive investment and financial support over the last 20 or 30 years. And that's been a very positive thing. But the negative is that they're intermittent. And so when wind is not blowing in the North Sea like it was last year, or it's not raining as much in certain parts of the world, you don't have the reliability of baseload power. The second aspect of renewables is you need very large battery backup systems to store power during those periods of intermittency. And there just isn't enough scale and cost efficiency to do that. So what can you rely on for reliable baseload power? Well, it's coal, it's not gas plants, and it's nuclear. So nuclear has a role to play in that kind of baseload power generation. In Europe, the price of natural gas and coal, for that matter, have absolutely skyrocketed in the last 12 months because the utilities there have become ever more dependent on using natural gas and coal as a backfill when renewables are intermittent. So nuclear is a reliable form of power. On average, it's a power plant operates 92.5% of the time. And you're not subject to the day-to-day supply disruptions and price disruptions that you're seeing right now in things like natural gas and coal. And I use a really simple example to illustrate this. So let's say I have a power plant, a nuclear power plant in the UK, and it needs to be refueled. Well, a couple of tractor trailers will roll into the power plant with fabricated fuel rods. They put them inside the nuclear reactor, they turn it on, and it essentially runs for 18 months continuously. If I think about the same size, same power generation, equivalent size of a nat gas plant, I basically need to pump in natural gas every single day to generate the same amount of power. So unless I've hedged my exposure to that natural gas price, I've got exposure to the price. And I also have now, as we've learned, unfortunately, I have potentially security of supply issues because things going on in the world. So this is why the price of natural gas can spike 800% in a very short period of time, because the supply is very, very vulnerable. So it's a very different dynamic between the different forms of power. So you have reliability, and you also have, you know, zero greenhouse gas emissions with nuclear. And this is why countries around the world, including the UK, have really piped up and said, look, we're making bigger investments in the sector to help meet our energy goals, transition goals, and also to have energy independence and security.
So that kind of brings on to the next question, because particularly in the UK, there's been much more talk about expansion of nuclear power capacity in the face of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the Prime Minister talking about an energy security strategy, and with nuclear playing a role in this. Could you kind of describe this globally as well, kind of what that's meant for other countries in terms of considering nuclear power as an alternative?
Yeah, I mean, look, nuclear power is always going to be a very polarizing topic to different parties. But I think if you look at what's happened in the last few years, governments have realized that nuclear needs to be part of the energy mix. So that doesn't mean everything is going to go nuclear, but governments are simply saying, look, we want to have some portion of our energy mix in nuclear, or we want to increase that share to wean off of the fossil fuel sources. France is kind of the leader right now in the world in terms of most of their energy is produced by nuclear. They've been the real big advocates. But a number of governments around the world have done big policy shifts in the last 12 months. And this is all about energy transition and security. You know, I look at the UK, there's been a number of different policy announcements. In continental Europe, you've got the Netherlands, which recently announced they would like to make more investments in nuclear power. The United States, under a Democratic Biden administration, has been very pro-nuclear with a number of different bills and as well as legislation that is providing financial support to extend the operating licenses of existing power plants and allowing them to compete more effectively with renewables. And then you have a whole bunch of countries that are looking and exploring the idea of nuclear power for the very first time, countries like Poland, Indonesia, Vietnam, Romania, Philippines, Kazakhstan. And then a number of countries that are very actively exploring the idea of expanding, you know, like Finland, India, and Japan is kind of the wild card in all this. Many of their power plants are still not operating. And there's a big push by both government and business there to turn on more reactors. So essentially that their lights don't turn off and their air conditioning doesn't turn off this summer, which they've already warned could happen. So governments around the world are very quickly shifting. This has gone into hyperdrive in the last few months because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and how that's impacted the entire energy supply chain.
You mentioned briefly about the kind of increased volatility of natural gas, but it seems to be a general point in terms of hydrocarbon gas, oil, is that they are massively affected by geopolitical events and the volatility of prices related to that. And so nuclear does seem like an obvious alternative in the face of this. But obviously, moving on maybe to uranium itself, which is obviously the key, for lack of a better term, ingredient in nuclear power. How stable are supplies of that globally? How much is that affected by geopolitics?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the uranium market has just emerged out of a 9-year bear market. So, our belief is that about a year ago, uranium fundamentals really shifted. We've seen a growing interest from investors around the world in uranium. And the reason for that is, yes, they're looking at the price of natural gas and coal and renewables for that matter. And they're saying, look, there's a role here for nuclear to play in these transitions. And the reality is that the price of uranium fell to such an uneconomic level back in 2016, 17, 18, 19, and 2020 that most of the world's largest producers basically scaled back production. So they either closed existing mines, and we saw that in Canada, Africa, Australia, or they basically cut back production. So Kazakhstan, which is the number one producer of uranium in the world, has basically flexed down their production by 20% the last several years. So that's created essentially a supply imbalance. And the world's been living off of secondary supplies of uranium for the last few years, but we think that's coming to an end. And the world is going to need a lot more uranium to not just fuel the existing fleet of reactors, which is growing, as well as all the reactors that are getting extensions in their operating life, as well as longer term to deal with the next generation of reactors, which are called small modular reactors, which governments around the world, including the UK, have announced financial support to develop these technologies. There's a bit of a technology commercialization race going on right now with SMRs that we think is really going to be the next generation of nuclear.
I wonder if you could go in a bit more detail on SMRs, actually, because obviously one of the big arguments against nuclear power is basically the cost of constructing and the plants. And we've seen in the UK in terms of a nuclear plant here, with massive delays and overruns, and the cost of the borrowing associated with that. But smaller modular reactors, SMRs, are seen as a kind of a solution to this.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. The big knock against nuclear is in terms of new builds has been they're very expensive to build up front, and unfortunately they tend to run over budget and over delivery window. The difference is a nat gas plant is very cheap to build, but then the fuel cost once you operate it is very high. So just to give you some perspective. A nat gas plant, 70% of the operating cost is the fuel. If you compare that against a nuclear power plant, about 5% of the total operating costs are fuel. But obviously, there's a much larger upfront investment. So the first knock against nuclear has obviously been the cost to build and the time overruns. But the second part that I find most people don't talk about as much is the versatility, meaning a lot of these power plants are very large. They are designed to power large cities. So what about smaller cities? What about smaller towns? And this is where this whole SMR concept comes in, that the idea here is if you could build a smaller sized reactor, one, it would be more versatile. You could apply it to a lot more locations. And second of all, you're going to build it basically in a factory beforehand, and you're going to then roll it out and assemble it on site. So the idea is that it would be cheaper to produce. It would be in a more controlled environment, just like a prefabricated house. And then you could deploy it to a lot more smaller sites, because these might be like 200 or 300 megawatt versus, some of these power plants, which could be 1,000 megawatts or more. And then I think the next element that a lot of people are excited about, including myself, is this idea of repurposing existing locations where a coal power plant exists and using that location as the new location for the SMR. And I have to give credit to the United States. They're kind of leading the charge on this right now. The state of Wyoming specifically, which is a coal state, by the way, is championing with a company funded in part by Bill Gates that is going to be repurposing an existing coal plant in the state of Wyoming and converting it into an SMR over the next few years. So this is going to be a pilot project that I think the whole world is going to be looking at very carefully.
Now, on the subject of uranium itself, maybe just for the uninitiated, you can start by kind of just explaining what uranium is and then what the journey it takes from being taken from the ground into eventually producing power that powers homes and factories, etc.
Sure. Well, you know, uranium is probably a very misunderstood element. The reality is uranium is a very plentiful element in the Earth's crust. It exists in very low grade deposits all over the place in the world. There are a few places in the world that have very high levels of uranium deposits, and Kazakhstan would be one. Canada would be two, in Athabasca Basin in Canada. And then you've got countries like Uzbekistan, Niger, and Namibia, and Australia are kind of round out the other key producing countries. So it's very plentiful in the Earth's crust, but it's in much higher concentrations in these basins in a select number of countries. It basically gets pulled out of the ground as either a rock or a solution. And it's turned into something called yellow cake, which literally looks like yellow powder or brownish powder. And we call that U308. It has a very low level of radioactivity. It's stored in steel drums, and that's what the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust essentially owns, is it owns U308. It's kind of the building block. It's the fundamental ingredient that takes on a long journey that ultimately goes inside of a nuclear reactor. What they essentially do with that U308 powder is they convert it into a gas called UF6. Then it gets enriched, and then ultimately it gets turned into these little pellets that get put inside of a fuel rod and goes inside a reactor to create a fission reaction. So it's a long kind of development and supply chain cycle. Utilities typically buy uranium years in advance of when they need it, because they don't run a just-in-time model. They never want their power plant to run out of fuel. And it's the interesting thing that's happening right now in the marketplace, falling out of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, is that Russia is a very big player, not so much in the production of U308. They produce about 14% globally, but they are a very large contributor of global capacity in the conversion and enrichment services of that supply chain that I mentioned. And right now, utilities around the world and the West are obviously trying to figure out, you know, how do I pivot away from those services that they've been procuring from Russia for many years, and they're quickly figuring out that there is no excess capacity in the West, and there is no excess capacity in the West because we went through a period of very low prices where it was uneconomic to keep those facilities operating. And so, you know, there's a very large facility, for example, in the United States that's been closed since 2017. So, you know, we find ourselves in a predicament right now where the world needs these facilities in friendly jurisdictions, but they've largely been operating under capacity or at zero capacity because of previous bear market. And that's obviously put tremendous pressure on the price. So we've seen the price of uranium go up about 52% in the last 12 months, but it's put a lot more pressure on the other elements of the fuel cycle that I mentioned. And so, for example, year to date, the price of conversion is up about 89%, and the price for enriched uranium year to date is up 50%. So the whole supply chain related to uranium has been highly disrupted because of the invasion of Ukraine.
Now, you mentioned uranium being in a bear market for several years, and then obviously now perhaps in some sort of kind of structural deficit. Could you describe kind of how that happened and what the last few decades of the uranium market has looked like?
Yeah, well, the uranium market's kind of gone through three cycles. The first cycle goes back to the early 1970s. It lasted for about 5 years, and the price of uranium went up about 600% over that time. And the catalyst for that cycle was really the oil crisis. It was the oil crisis that OPEC initiated on the West, and Western government said, you know, we're not going to go through that again. We're not going to be at the mercy of OPEC. And so that was really the catalyst for the initial build out of nuclear reactors in the Western world. And with that build out created a big demand for uranium, and that helped the price of uranium go up 600%. The second cycle was in the early 2000s up until just before the great financial crisis of 08. And that was really the commodity super cycle where China was, you know, rapid urbanization of its growth of its economy, and also China building out a huge amount of new nuclear power plants. And that was really just an epic bull market where the price of uranium over a 6.5 year period went up 1800%. So that was absolutely stunning. And then you had Fukushima happen, the earthquake, tsunami, and the power plant damage. And that obviously set the whole sector in a downward spiral that lasted about 9 years. And so the price of uranium in the peak of 07 hit almost $140 a pound in the spot market. It troughed all the way down to about $16 in 2016. And since then, we've been slowly grinding higher. And right now, we're about $50 a pound. So the price, as I mentioned, has appreciated over 50% in the last 12 months. But we are still way below where we were pre-Fukushima, which was around $70-odd, and well off the last commodity peak of June 2007, where we hit 140.
So obviously for investors who think that uranium market is in a bull market now, or is set to start to be in one, at least one of those ways to gain exposure is through uranium mining companies. So what's the potential benefit of looking at the miners themselves as a way to gain exposure?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that I find fascinating about this commodity is that it's a critical commodity in that you cannot substitute it. And it is used to generate 10% of the world's electricity. So it's a critical element. It produces a lot of electricity for the world. Obviously, it produces much more electricity in places like the UK, Canada, and the United States. It's really astonishing to me that 70% of all the uranium produced is from state-owned or state-controlled companies. And those state-owned and state-controlled companies happen to be in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Russia, and China. You know, countries that obviously are not part of the West. So it is a supply chain that is kind of lopsided right now to the Eastern Bloc. And so a lot of these mining companies that happen to survive through that 9 year bear market are basically domiciled in either North America, Australia, and then Kazatomprom, which is the largest producer in the world, listed on the London Stock Exchange and is based in Kazakhstan, of course. But there's a range of different companies. And what's amazing to me is that, as I mentioned, it's a critical mineral, produces 10% of the world's electricity. But if you look at the publicly available companies to invest in, when you look at some of the different indexes out there, you'll find very quickly that there might be 35 or 38 companies listed in a particular uranium mining index, but only two of the companies are producers. And you might say, well, that's crazy. Like, how could there only be two companies producing, publicly traded companies that are producing uranium? But that's the case. I mean, Kazatomprom and Cameco, the Canadian company, are the two publicly traded companies that are actively producing. And then you have a whole lot of other companies that have deposits that have basically been mothballed or put on care and maintenance for many, many years because during the bear market, there was just no capital or interest to develop those deposits. And one of the things that I tell people about mining is that it's incredibly capital intensive, but it's more so time intensive. And if you're wondering what do I mean by that is the supply response for mining is very slow because of the time it takes to find a discovery, basically create all the feasibility studies around it, get the environmental permitting, and then actually constructing the mine and then producing. That journey often can be 12 to 15 years. So when you think about a structural supply deficit in a particular mineral and you say, oh, well, you know, that's fine. We'll just fire up those mines and we'll get more mineral, right? It's like, no, that it doesn't work that way. There aren't big reserves of minerals just sitting there in warehouses. The reality is the uranium market has got itself into a real supply deficit. And I'll just give you some basic stats to illustrate what I'm talking about. If you look at the 440 odd reactors around the world, they need 180 million pounds of uranium every single year as their base fuel. The mines today, and those are all the publicly traded ones and the state-owned companies and whatnot, they only produce 130 million pounds a year. So there's been a 50 million pound deficit. And this is the most fundamental point that most investors I've talked to around the world have anchored on in the last couple of years, which is, how do you have a market that is so out of whack in terms of its supply and its demand? And you might ask, well, how is the industry even operated if there's a 50 million pound deficit? And, you know, it's very technical. I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this, but essentially the world's been living off of secondary supplies and some other techniques that they've been able to basically squeeze more uranium out of the fuel cycle. And that is obviously coming to an end because these conversion facilities who've been helping to supply uranium in the face of the structural deficit, we believe are going to have to swing to be net users of uranium to accelerate the migration away from these Russian suppliers. So there's a big shift going on right now. And we think the mining companies are really well positioned here because if there's a higher commodity price, that supports their ability to raise new equity capital and or debt, basically restart mines that have been closed. And there's been a number of them announced. So Cameco a few months ago announced that McArthur River, which is one of the biggest uranium mines in the world, will be restarting in the next year or so. It's been closed for 4 years. So they now are at a point of confidence where they have the price and the contracts to be able to reopen that mine. There's other companies such as Boss Energy and Paladin who have mines in Africa and Australia that have been on care and maintenance for the last few years that are getting closer to reopening. So these mines coming back online are obviously going to generate a tremendous amount of cash flow for these companies and get them back in business because a lot of them have been idled. And then, you know, if you go down the food chain, there's a bunch of development companies that have really good deposits that are waiting for the right market environment to fund and build. They will provide uranium, but not for several years out. And then finally, you've got exploration companies, which are really focused on greenfield projects, you know, which are really the potential new mines of the future. And those could be 10 or 15 years out from now. So it's an exciting time because the sector has finally come out of a 9-year bear market. Interest is coming back to the sector because the commodity price is becoming more viable again for them to operate, and investors are helping to recapitalize these companies. And you know, I often use this example of if you took the market capitalization of all 80 publicly traded uranium companies, they're probably worth $30 billion right now, maybe even less with the recent correction. And if you compare that against some of the oil and gas companies that exist in the world. You know, Exxon, for example, is 10 times the value of the collective 80 companies. So the market capitalization of these uranium companies is really, really tiny because where we are in the cycle and they have a lot of room to grow. And if you're bullish on the commodity price longer term, then you should be bullish on the miners because historically the miners have much more upside in a rising commodity price environment. And we've seen this over every other bull market where the price of the commodity might be X and the price of the miners typically will go up, you know, sometimes 2X over the same period because of that operating leverage that they typically have.
Now, when it comes to other commodities, often investors will gain exposure through an ETC or an ETF that might have exposure to the spot price or the futures index. There's not really a case with uranium, and instead these kind of closed-end structures are used for investors trying to gain direct exposure or spot price exposure to the commodity. Could you kind of explain why that is? Why these kind of these structures don't exist already in terms of ETFs or ETCs, and then why how these kind of closed-end spot price funds work?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about commodity markets. Historically, from almost every commodity, there are three ways that investors can get exposure to them. They can somehow get exposure to the spot, the physical commodity itself. Sometimes that's possible if you're a large investor. And then in some cases, you can buy that through some kind of an ETC or exchange listed vehicle. There are sometimes futures contracts that you can buy either direct or through, again, some kind of exchange listed vehicle. And then finally, there's the producers. The reality is that not all the commodities have an active and liquid futures market. So that eliminates a lot of commodities. Second of all, there are a lot of commodities that are very difficult to put inside, physical commodities that are very difficult to wrap inside of an exchange listed vehicle, mainly because the cost to store them is prohibitive. And that really results because of the value of the commodity relative to the volume of the commodity. Sometimes there's issues with a commodity degrading over time if it's stored too long, et cetera, et cetera. So things like gold and silver, platinum and palladium are easy to store. And then, you think about the equities, whether you're looking at a producer, a developer, an exploration company, they all have different levels of risks, based on their stage of development, the size of the companies, their cash flows, and their liquidity. But, the reality is whether you're a producer of copper or uranium, you're still an equity, you're still a stock. And what we find is that correlations of commodity stocks to broader markets is moderate. And so when general markets sell off, it's often these commodity equity sectors fall in tandem with general equity sell off. So we have investors that like to play the physical commodity markets if a vehicle is available, and then other investors also like to supplement that exposure with the equities because of that kind of operating leverage I mentioned before. In the world of uranium, Sprott about a year ago acquired a vehicle called Uranium Participation Corp, which then got reorganized to the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. And that vehicle holds about 56 million pounds of U308 in it. So this is a category of funds where you're actually able to get exposure to the underlying physical commodity that's stored. And it's proven to be a very popular choice amongst investors to gain exposure to the uranium sector. Again, it's very convenient way for an investor to gain exposure to a commodity that they otherwise couldn't gain access to. So the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust is the largest fund in the world. It's about $2.6 billion, and it trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange as well as the U.S. OTC. There are other vehicles that are similar. Well, one trades in London, but it's much smaller and less liquid. As I mentioned earlier, the equities are the other way to play the sector, and have received a lot of interest in the last 12 months as the sector's kind of come back to life. So, we think it's the best way to play it is to gain exposure across the continuum. So, gaining exposure to some producers, some developers, some exploration companies, as well as proxies that hold the physical metal. We think it's a good way to gain exposure across the whole food chain.
Now, final question. I'm sure you're waiting for it. In terms of the safety of nuclear power, because obviously, as you mentioned, with the Fukushima incident, the last 10 years saw Germany and Japan close down plants due to safety worries. And everyone's seen the Chernobyl TV show now. Obviously, all familiar with the real historical incident. So, how safe is nuclear energy now?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us, are well aware of, everyone knows the word Chernobyl and Fukushima. So, they're obviously very scary events. But if you take a step back and look at the forms of energy production holistically, nuclear actually is one of the safest. If you look at all of the power ever produced by nuclear energy and all of the injuries and deaths ever caused by it, it's been proven it's actually one of the safest. The most dangerous is actually coal. You think about coal mining, it's very dangerous. Not the friendliest work environment for people in the coal industry. So if you look at the stats, you'll see that coal is the dirtiest form of energy production. It's also the least safe in terms of its mining and production. Nonetheless, people are, you know, obviously get very afraid of nuclear because of large scale accidents. And unfortunately, when you go back to Chernobyl, for example, that was a fundamental design flaw, meaning it was a Soviet era nuclear power plant that had no containment field built over the reactor. That is absolutely not the case today with any of the reactors around the world. I think the world figured out, unfortunately, the hard way that you can't build a reactor without a containment field. And these containment fields are very, very safe, and it basically ensures that nothing leaks out of them if there is any kind of accident. You know, unfortunately, with Fukushima, the earthquake and tsunami that damaged the reactor was an unfortunate incident. But, you know, I think the track record overall is very good. Some of the best power plants in the world, coincidentally, we're in Germany, which, as you know, have been closing down over the last few years. And I think German energy policy is probably a great case study in dysfunction in terms of them closing down some of the safest power plants and most efficient power plants, nuclear power plants in the world over the last few years, and switching to nat gas and renewables, which has obviously caused complete chaos with their grid right now. And Germany is burning more coal right now than they've ever, because they're worried about conserving nat gas for winter heating. So I also think that the sentiment about nuclear has really changed irrespective of the historical accidents, because I find people are more concerned today and fearful about climate change than they are a large-scale nuclear power plant accident. And that's pretty profound to say, but I think many people, irrespective of where you live in the world, has experienced climate change in some way, whether it's flooding, heat, ice storms, forest fires, because I know I have. And so I think people are more concerned about climate change and decarbonization of the grid than they are on the operating safety track records of nuclear power plants. And that's my opinion.
Thanks, John. And thank you to our listeners. So I'm sure you found that as fascinating as I did. Anyone wants any more information, please head to handetf.com. Thanks.